Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. For the past 14 Julys, readers and writers of science fiction, fantasy, and horror have gathered in Boston for the ReaderCon conference. This year, as in the past couple of years, the conference was held in the Burlington Marriott Hotel. There were no Klingon honor guards or Jedi Knights parading through the halls, and no auditoriums packed with starstruck fans waiting for a glimpse of their favorite stars. At the ReaderCon, the guests of honor are respected authors, SF critics, and editors. This year, the co-honorees were Octavia Butler and Gwyneth Jones. Both are women in a male-dominated genre, Butler a black woman, writing intelligent novels praised for their social consciousness, Jones a leftish British author who writes in a postmodern style. Black SF icon Samuel Delaney wandered the book vendor space along with classic SF writers like Hal Clement and contemporary stylists like Paul DeFilippo. I've taped interviews and talks at previous ReaderCons for broadcast and had a grand time. But this ReaderCon, I had a more serious purpose, to challenge these SF opinion makers to help the public imagine a positive post-human future. SF tropes are used in public bioethics controversies as debate-stopping epithets, Brave New World, Frankenstein, Boys from Brazil, Stepford Wives. At the 2002 ReaderCon, I moderated a panel on speculative fiction and transhumanism to discuss whether SF writing could help bring about a happier transhuman transition. The panelists were Jennifer Barlow, Marcel Gagné, and Matt Jarpy. Jennifer Barlow is the author of a body of short fiction, as well as the novel Hamlet Dreams. Marcel Gagné is also an author and editor of short fiction, and is a Linux guru, author of Linux System Administration. Matt Jarpy is an author of short fiction, and a PhD biochemist. My name is Jay Hughes, and I want to give a brief introduction to this topic and why I proposed it. I'm a bioethicist and sociologist, and about 10 years ago, 12 years ago now, I taught a course on the politics of science fiction in Chicago, and some of my interests started to converge. I began to realize around the same time that I was, as a bioethicist, way out on one end of the spectrum, a spectrum that began to be referred to in some circles as transhumanist, that I was not at all upset about cloning or a lot of the other kinds of transhuman possibilities, technologies that were coming on the market in the future, and began to write about those things. And another interest that I had was in the sociology of science fiction and its effects on people. I did a survey about 10 years ago, 8 years ago now, where I asked people, I asked bioethicists and environmental activists, their attitudes towards a number of things. One thing was towards animal rights. I asked them about 9 different animals, whether they were willing to see those animals sacrificed for medical research purposes. And the animals ranged from fish and rats to dolphins and chimpanzees. And another one of the questions on the survey was, do you watch Star Trek on TV? It was around this time of Star Trek The Next Generation. And do you read science fiction on a frequent or sometimes or never basis? And it turned out that those two questions combined predicted a lot about people's attitudes towards animal rights, and which was gratifying because it was kind of purely self-indulgent exercise at that point. But it turned out that people's attitudes towards their willingness to sacrifice animals generally sloped down from being very willing to sacrifice fish and rats towards less willing to sacrifice dolphins and chimpanzees. For science fiction consumers, the slope looked like this. But for everybody else, it looked like this, which in other words meant that science fiction consumers had some kind of different attitude towards intelligence, towards the slope of intelligence, and what ethical significance it had for people. And so that got me very interested. Is science fiction a vehicle or a reflector? It could be both. It could be either a vehicle introducing some kind of specific or particular socioethical attitudes into the population, or it could be a reflector of changing contemporary norms towards the other, reflected in non-human intelligence in different forms. So for the last couple of years, I've been collecting data and coding the data in about non-human intelligence reflected in film, television, and literature in a variety of different forms, machine minds, aliens, various forms of non-human species on Earth, and so forth. Proposal for this particular panel, to get back to this panel, came from, I'm now the secretary of the World Transhumanist Association, and our president is a philosopher named Nick Bostrom, who's at Yale. He is frequently, when he's being talked to by the press about cloning or genetic engineering or germline engineering or whatever, the tropes of science fiction are thrown in his face, as I'm sure you've all heard with these debates. Brave New World, Frankenstein, now with the Attack of the Clones, Boys from Brazil. There are all kinds of tropes, of images from science fiction that are used as kind of debate-stopping epithets, which are seen to be some kind of a paradigmatic end point of what's going to happen if we allow these things to develop. And I agreed with him that that was problematic, and he said, you know, why can't we think of better ways to do this? Science fiction consumers are different people. We have different attitudes. We are more positive towards the future, towards technology, towards the other in general than the average population. What do you see as our mission? Do we have a mission? I know that the idea of a mission in literature or art is always controversial, but we can talk about that. Do science fiction people have a mission, like the old Futurians thought, to change society in some particular way, to facilitate a transhuman, a positive attitude towards the transhuman transition? Do science fiction writers see that as their mission? How do you see these tropes playing out in different kinds of science fiction literature, film, and fiction? And I'll leave it with that for now. Would you like to start, Jennifer?
My name is Jennifer Barlow. My first novel just came out this year called Hamlet Dreams. It has nothing to do with transhumanism whatsoever. However, I think in many ways my first ever published short story falls into that realm and might be one of those more negative depictions. It's called Technically Alive, and the story is about a woman who has a very, very, very premature baby, who's premature because it's not really a viable fetus, and the ever more heroic efforts that medicine makes to keep this child alive. And the question posed there is kind of, somewhere along the way of this story, this child really stops being human. Now, how you know when that is the question that is fascinating to me about this whole idea. Somewhere, I mean, you can replace a person part by part until they're nothing but electronics and medical miracles. And I think part of the reason that when it is depicted in a frightening or negative way in science fiction, it's often this fear of losing your humanity and yourself.
Do you think that that's the dominant view that you've adopted in your work? Or?
No.
As a person, are you particularly concerned about that?
I don't know that I'm particularly concerned about that yet. But I can see where, as technology continues, there can get to a point where I would really be concerned about that. Which doesn't mean I would impose my view on everyone else, because society changes to adapt to these things. And I think if we did have, you know, the ability to transcend our humanity, that the society would grow with that idea and it would become accepted. And people like me would be the old fogies, you know. Oh, those kids today.
That's a classic science fiction theme right there.
Yeah, and I think that's a natural progression. And it would happen regardless of what any of us might say if we found it horrifying. I'm sure, you know, our great-grandparents might have found it horrifying that, you know, women today go out and work in the workplace and don't choose to have children. So that's just kind of a natural way that society goes. And that might be the next major step that we take.
It seems like there are two kinds of problems that fiction writers have with transhuman possibilities of depicting them in their literature. One is the kind of complaint about utopian literature, that it's just boring. It would be a boring future if there was no illness, if there was no, if there were extremely longevity, people had all the different kinds of, if there's abundance and no conflict over material goods. I think the other is the kind of H.G. Wells complaint, that what if we create in our fiction people who we can't relate to? Who are so different, so strange, that we won't be able to relate to their concerns and their needs.
you can see that as concerns?
I'm not sure how to answer that exactly. I think that we'd be able to relate to them as well as our ancestors would be able to relate to us. There would still be this common bond, but there's a natural falling away as time goes on. As culture in itself and as humanity as it evolves and changes, that's one of the things when I read a story about somebody who lives a really long time, I think, you know, what must it be like to be 100 years old and remember, you know, to have grown up in a society of the values that
I think it would be excellent.
I don't know.
No, that's the bottom line. I mean, I've been saying for years that, you know, I love Spider Robinson's line, "I want to live forever, die trying," because quite honestly, I mean, the whole notion that we get to live a short lifespan on this planet, you know, and let's face it, I don't care what anybody says, 80 or 90 years is freaking short. I mean, that is just not enough time to really start to get the feel of this place.
You're listening to a panel on speculative fiction and transhumanism, held on July 14th, 2002, at the 14th Annual ReaderCon in Burlington, Massachusetts.
First of all, my name is Marcel Gagne. I've been to various cons and places from time to time. I have written some amount of science fiction short stories. I've edited a couple of anthologies and published a magazine called Transversions. Most people know me as the Linux guy or the Linux chef. Specifically, I write the Cooking with Linux column in Linux Journal. I also write for Inform IT, SysAdmin Magazine, Unix Review, and most recently I published this book called Linux System Administration: A User's Guide, which, by the way, was voted one of the top 10 technical books of 2001 and the only Linux book on the list, I want to point out.
Thank you very much.
My new book comes out in the spring. Anyway, one of the reasons that I actually ticked off my name beside this panel was that aside from the fact that over the years I've been accused of being a techno geek, in other words, you know, I'm always pushing the latest technology and the latest technological ideas. Hell, I push it in my writing. I do, you know, 4 or 5 columns every month in which I talk about where technology is going and how people can use that technology and adapt it to their lives and do cool things with it. Let's face it, because hey, that's the whole reason that science fiction people like science fiction, because it's cool. I mean, that's the reason. About 3 weeks ago, I had lunch with the guy who wrote this book, Steve Mann. A lot of people refer to him as the cyborg. And Steve is a very interesting character, to say the least. He runs, he's the inventor of the Wearcomp, the wearable computer. And he's been playing with mediated reality and being a cyborg for, I don't know, 30 years or something like that. He's been fascinated with the idea for ages. And, of course, he's, I think, partly of his own doing, but he's also put up with an awful lot of ridicule and an awful lot of strange stares and looks and so forth, a lot of which I think he brought on himself on purpose. In other words, he was being deliberately, you know, antagonistic to try to, you know, and I felt that in the conversation that I had with him at lunchtime. He's really trying to see if he can shock people to this very day. But he really does believe in the idea that we can take these technologies and not necessarily enhance, which is a lot of what your association talks about, but mediate reality, change the way that we look at things. And in changing the way that we look at things and the way that information is transmitted to us and picked up by us, that we will get a different picture of life. It will cause us to think differently. And that thinking differently is the first step towards becoming something different than what we actually are. In fact, he argues that we've been cyborgs for centuries. Because he argues that being a cyborg is simply a means of enhancing one's abilities with technology. And we started doing that when we were wearing eyeglasses, when we started using watches, when we started using any kind of technology that you will either carry with you, wear with you. I wear a pair of Nike Air Soles at the moment, which is, again, an enhancing technology. The idea being that I can land from a greater height, or I can jump higher by using these things, despite the fact that I'm not any more athletic than I was before I put the damn things on. Yeah. And I got this nice man over here talk.
That's sure. I'm Matt Darby. I write science fiction. I've had a couple of short stories in Asimov's. And I guess the reason that I ticked off that I was interested in this panel is that I just finished reading the Cassini Division, so that's got a lot of the issues of posthumanism, transhumanism. And I really have to realize when I read the description of this panel that I have sort of a visceral dislike of the post-humans. I really, you know, especially after reading the Cassini Division, which does not paint a very pretty picture of what it's going to be like when people can edit themselves. For those of you who haven't read it, the basic storyline is people have uploaded themselves into smart matter computers and have become something that's not human, and the humans are at war with them.
Jupiter brains.
Yeah, they essentially turn Jupiter into a giant computer and load themselves into it. And so they the post-humans in that book are not very nice people at all, and they must be destroyed. And so it's just the way Ken McLeod painted that picture, and a few other stories that I've read that really...
In fact, Ken McLeod was directly inspired by his surfing on the Extropian list here in the... Well, it's based in the States.
Mm-hmm.
But he found the Extropians to be the most alien subculture he'd ever surfed into, and basically concluded that in the future we would have to destroy them.
Yeah. But the reason that I ticked off on this panel, not just because I hate the transhumans, I don't really, you know, I feel like, well, you know, if you're immersed in science fiction, then they're real enough to you. It's, but you know, I'd like to sort of work my way through this, because I realize this is kind of a prejudice that I read these things and I think, oh my God, we can't do this to ourselves. And I've been working on a book where people are, you know, they're what you would call post-humans. They've got some enhancements to their ability, things that are not natural. We wouldn't recognize them as humans, at least their minds as humans. And I want these people to be good guys. And so I'm trying to work my way through my sort of visceral dislike of the post-humans. And I think that after... finishing the Cassini Division, and after thinking about it for a long time, just trying to identify what this dislike is for this whole process, is that when you can edit yourself, when you can edit your own mind and change your own ideas, I think all bets are off, that you will essentially become the most selfish creature that could ever exist, because the only reason why we're not completely selfish as humans is because we can't get rid of that self.
Except I disagree with you. And no, you can leave the mic. I'm sure it'll pick me up. Yeah, I'm sure I can make it to the back of the room. Anyway, the reason that I disagree with you on that, and by the way, I do have, like, one of the things that I actually liked about your little pamphlet here, we're also working to address the potential dangers that will come with our new technological powers. However, two things. First of all, I think that if you ignore technology and where the technology is going, and you don't seek to understand the technology, it will do more damage to you than if you just sit back and go, I'm really scared of this stuff. So the problem is not too much technology. Sometimes it's too little technologies, and you really don't understand it, and then you're letting somebody else take care of the problems for you. So I think it's important that people have a somewhat of an understanding. The other thing that you talked about is it's not natural. Okay, and one of my favorite quotes from way back when is a Heinlein one, where he talks about how is a dam built by human beings for human purposes any less natural than a dam built by beavers for beaver purposes? And I always thought that was an interesting way to look at things. You know, anything we do by definition is natural because we're natural beings. I mean, we come out of nature.
Although when we get to the point where we can change ourselves,
but we change ourselves on a daily basis, though.
Change ourselves to the point where we wouldn't recognize ourselves the next day.
That's
going to start to run away.
You're listening to a panel on speculative fiction and transhumanism, held on July 14th, 2002, at the 14th Annual ReaderCon in Burlington, Massachusetts. The panelists were myself, Jay Hughes, Jennifer Barlow, Marcel Gagne, and Matt Jarpy. To find out more about ReaderCon, go to readercon.org. The 2003 schedule is already posted there.
On the editing yourself idea, I agree with problems, but that's something that is going to be obvious. I mean, editing yourself is like having control of your own heartbeat. You're going to kill yourself if you just get runaway feedback. The same thing, people are not going to be editing their minds freely. The ones who do are going to go insane, and the ones who see them go insane, if that ever happens, are going to say, wait a minute, we got to be careful about this. Not that we can't do it, but that I need some friction here. I need some. I need a backup. I need to do this carefully, or I can make myself insane.
In Greg Against Diaspora, I don't know if you remember, the AI minds in that story adopt personality modules that kind of lock themselves in for some period of time so that they're not constantly floating from one set of beliefs and identities and memories to another. They consciously construct a self and say, this is my self that I went for at least until I change it.
Joe Halderman's All My Sins Remembered, the same idea, you know, like you adopt a completely new personality and a completely, you know, different way of being for the purpose of doing a particular job. Reality, I mean, we're constantly editing reality. We're constantly changing things. One of the biggest things that's been in the news, of course, is the whole false memory syndrome. People talking about, you know, events that supposedly happened to them 30 years ago and so forth. And you say you wouldn't recognize yourself. Well, apparently they don't recognize themselves because they're thinking thoughts. You know, in fact, they're aching over things that happened to them supposedly 30 years before. It's destroying their lives. They're going down the toilet. They're on the verge of committing suicide, doing terrible things to themselves and other people over things that never happened. So humans edit themselves constantly.
But wouldn't you think, if you're editing yourself in a technological way, I think what ends up being scary about that is, as an individual, you think that there's something unique about the way you are. But if anybody can sit there and play with who they are and make themselves into another person, then what is it about you that's special and where is the you in you? And if you do this editing, you lose that feeling.
I think you do, actually.
If you're changing something about yourself, your perception of yourself changes. I mean, the classic thing, of course, is, you know, you go into a suit store and you buy yourself a nice suit and you walk out and you walk very differently when you walk out of the store with a suit on. Or you go get a nice haircut and you know it looks good. You're very different walking out after that.
See, this doesn't bother me because I'm a Buddhist, and so Buddhists don't believe in the self. It's just an illusion.
But you guys are wrong, though.
Well, that may be. But I have an essay, just shameless self-promotion, on the web called The Future of Death, where I argue that transhuman technology will make us all Buddhists, that precisely for the reason that you described. If you're constantly, if you have self-control of selfness, you eventually realize how illusory it is.
At night, I take off my watch when I go to sleep. I was told by somebody else that he doesn't take off his watch. He always keeps his watch on. No, you never know. You get up in the middle of the night, you need to check what time it is. You know, of course you want your watch on. Personally, I think that's nuts. I don't want anything on my body when I go to bed at night. Nothing. And
that's more than all right.
You know what I'm saying, and you're stretching this. You know, throw the sex into the discussion, why don't you? Anyway,
we'll get there.
Oh, will we? Really? Oh, anyway. The point is I like the idea of being able to have this thing remember 700 or 800 addresses and phone numbers. I like the idea that something reminds me of what time it is. I like the idea that if I have some thought when I'm, you know, somewhere along, that I can sit there and turn a gizmo on. I like the idea that I could even, you know, that this was, it isn't, but I wish it was wireless so I could, you know, tap into the net and get some information quickly. All that sort of thing. However, I don't want that stuff on me. You know, I want to be able to take all that stuff off. In other words, I want to be able to enhance myself through the day or as I'm walking through the world or whatever, but I don't want to feel like I'm encumbered by all these things, and I don't want to be encumbered by these things. In fact, I want to be able to separate myself from them as I see fit.
And I have a monkey wrench to throw into this, considering especially what I've been saying. One thing that's always interested me in this kind of, transhumanist tendency to have somebody who has, say, depression or psychosis, you give them a drug, and they become different. Now, is that...
Normal.
Well, that might be stretching.
But normal.
Yes, but we already have the ability to change what beforehand one might consider a part of ourselves. I mean, that's your personality. And you can change it with a drug.
Did you do but drugs in the 60s? No, I'm kidding.
I recommend to you headweb.com. I don't know if any of you have seen it. Headweb.com has a huge set of articles about drugs and discourses on different kinds of opiates and things like that. But the basic argument written in a manifesto there is called the hedonistic imperative, is that transhuman technology should be pushing us towards giving ourselves bliss all the time, basically. That we don't want to be normal. We want to be happier than we've ever been in the future and take away all pain. You've been listening to a panel on speculative fiction and transhumanism that was held at the 14th Annual ReaderCon, a science fiction convention held every summer in Burlington, Massachusetts. The panelists were myself, Jay Hughes, Jennifer Barlow, Marcel Gagne, and Matt Jarpy. To find out more about ReaderCon, go to readercon.org. The 2003 schedule is already posted there. One of the members of the audience asked a question about whether our attitudes towards post-humans are shaped by our attitudes towards the disabled.
Why didn't Geordi on the Enterprise, why didn't everybody have those little... I always wonder, you know, if these things are so useful, why don't we all have them?
Let me jump in. Who's the NPR correspondent who's in the wheelchair? John Hockenberry. Yeah. John Hockenberry has a wonderful article in Wired from a couple years ago about how disabled people are the transhuman pioneers, how they will all be adopting... Yeah, cyborg technology. I think actually we have, before we get to the disabled, which I absolutely agree with you, and actually Gregor Wahlbring, who's the director of the International Association of Disability and Bioethics and who's a thalidomide survivor, doesn't have any legs, he's becoming a transhumanist slowly. I'm working on him. And he's going to be appearing on my radio show on a regular basis. But I think before we get to the disabled, I want to read you this one passage from 1955 from James Blish. And this is from the collection Superman, Tales of the Post-Human Future, which Dessois just put out. And the character here is a fish-like post-human who's going back to recolonize Earth and is suffering terrible discrimination on the ship that is taking him back to Earth. And he says to the captain here, "Of course there was resistance back there at the beginning. The kind of mind that had only recently been persuaded that colored men are human beings was quick to take the attitude that an adapted man, any adapted man, was the social inferior of the primary or basic human type, the type that lived on Earth. But it was also a very old idea on Earth that the basic humanity inheres in the mind and not in the form. You see, Captain, all this might have still been prevented had it been possible to maintain the attitude that changing the form, even in part, makes a man less of a man than he was in the primary state. But the day has come when the attitude is no longer tenable, a day that is the greatest of all moral watersheds for a race, the day that it is to unite all our divergent currents of attitudes towards each other into one common reservoir of brotherhood and purpose." So obviously coming out of civil rights awareness of the 1950s, but you see the same attitude, the same idea about what transhumanism is reflected in Schismatrix and the idea of transhumanism there in Sterling's work.
I said I wanted to get back to the technology thing briefly, and one of the things that Sally and I were having this discussion about this, I'm a huge proponent of technology and using technology and so forth, but I also somewhat distrust technology. So I'm a permanent schism, you know, in terms of this whole thing, because I love it, I push it, I talk about it, you know, but on the other hand, it's like the reason I love it and push it and talk about it and so forth is because I actually want people to understand it. You know, I don't want them to be ruled by it. And the whole notion of if I could have a box embedded in me, some gizmo, whatever the heck it looks like or whatever, whose entire job was to produce little nanobots that continually rebuilt my body so that, you know, if there was plaque building up in my arteries, it cleaned it out. If there was cellular damage caused by something, it dealt with it. If there was a tumor growing somewhere, it eradicated it. So that essentially I was constantly being repaired, being taken care of, and so forth.
And
I would go
fat.
What's that?
They burn fat.
And they burn fat. Thank you. Absolutely.
That's
anyway,
true.
And I can eat anything I want.
Yes.
If I could have that gizmo, I would take it in an instant. Yeah. I mean, I would not even stop to think. I mean, what a great idea. This is like the perfect thing. On the other hand, if I had some chip embedded... my friend Rob Sawyer has a book where he's got these companion implants that are embedded in your arm. I would not want this sucker. I don't want this thing. I don't want something that's recording everything that's happening to me in my life. I don't want something that's actually, you know, that's embedded in my body, typed or connected to some world database or world net or something like that, because invariably information flows in both directions, and I want to be able to decide when the information flows out. You know, I can, you know, I'm perfectly happy with having a whole bunch, you know, flowing out or flowing in for that matter. I like to have some control over what's coming in and some control over what's going out.
You need a firewall.
Bingo. I want a personal firewall built in. As it is right now, I am my personal firewall because I can turn this sucker off or I can pull the plug on something.
Well,
but if it's embedded
in
me,
the question is how
your firewall's permeable.
how much are we really autonomous now? I mean, how much does technology make us really less autonomous than we currently think we are? I mean, I think that's part of the problem.
No man is an island.
Exactly. Yeah back here.
I think there are two major thrusts of transhumanism, and I think one of them is of great concern to me. And the one that I fully support is what we've been discussing about bringing people up to what we might define as a societal normal baseline, either people are handicapped using technology. I think that's great, but it seems like the holy grail of a lot of writing about transhumanism that I've read in SF, and I haven't really read the philosophy that much, but is life extension. And life extension is, it seems like the whole human species has used non-corporeal means to extend their lives in terms of art, literature, you know, Shakespeare saying, I write these things so I'll be immortal. And if we don't have the physical carrying capacity for everyone to live forever, especially unless we eliminate the birth rate. If we go for some sort of corporeal immortality, how can we sustain it?
Don't you think that would be an inevitable effect, though, of an extended lifespan or a kind of immortality? I mean, we produce children so that the human race can continue. I mean, we get into the selfish gene thing that Peter was talking about here. You know, our genes need to continue existing. Well, if our genes can continue existing without us producing a whole batch of children all the time, why would we?
I think Brian Stableford has a wonderful answer to your plaint. In this particular book, the novella is called Mortimer Gray's History of Death. And basically, the character has an unlimited lifespan, and he takes it upon himself when he's about 20 to write a history, definitive history of death. He brings out one volume every 50 years, and he concludes it after 10 volumes when he's 500 years old. But by giving himself this kind of life project, it's a guiding principle for his entire 500-year span of the story, as well as allowing you to have the richness and complexity to master everything that would really be required in 1,000 years to be a historian of death. I think that those are the kinds of projects. Our ideas about what our life projects will be will increase if we have increased longevity.
Now, here's one of one of the scary issues of transhumanism. Whatever method we find to improve your physical abilities, let you, change into a lion if you want to, whatever it is, or live forever, it's going to be expensive. And there's going to be the haves and the have-nots.
Initially.
Well, but that's one of the great fears, and one of the things that's often, when I've read, novels of it, that is the terrifying issue that ends up in a lot of the ones that I've read.
That's a weird point.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, haves and have-nots is, I suppose you could argue it's a natural condition because it's always been around, and of course species compete against other species and so on and so forth. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, if we were as smart as we like to think we are, let's put it this way, if we took the intelligence that we have to its logical conclusions even today, we could eradicate hunger, we could deal with like huge problems in the world, we could, we could do away with poverty and so forth. There's no reason why we can't tackle those problems. I mean, we're perfectly capable. We have, or to quote from something else, we have the power, we have the technology. We can make people better than they are, faster, and so on.
Yeah, but maybe I'm very cynical here, but
you're being too cynical. See, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's a great flipping world out there if we only make it that way.
Yeah, but the people who have the power to do it.
I think she's right. The one thing that I've found in a lot of transhumanists is an overwhelming sense of optimism that you can solve all the problems, and I don't think the issue is, I can fix your body. The problem isn't that my body can fix the social structures around which you're going to do that with, and that's not a technological thing.
It's important to recognize that there's a potential for loss, and sometimes great loss. I mean, a movie that was out, everybody see Gattaca?
Yeah.
I mean, that was a great movie. I mean, and damn terrifying. And the reason I thought it was really terrifying is because I could see it happening, like, almost to the letter. I mean, it was so easy to believe.
Now, that's not fiction.
Oh, I know, but it was so easy to see this in just, 15, 20 years from now, this social strata developing. And I think that, and one of the things that scares me about this whole notion, like right now they've just gone for a moratorium for 4 years in the U.S. on
stem cell
research. I mean, for God's sakes. But anyway, that ignoring that this technology exists, ignoring that this is a possible future, saying we'll talk about it another day, is the formula for disaster. Because it's going to happen around you. I mean, it's going to happen to other people, and we will become the disenfranchised because other people will take advantage of it. And when people have, you know, have a big advantage over you, unfortunately, they tend to use
it. The Japanese rolled off the world for 200 years, and then when Perry came in, they couldn't do a damn thing. The Chinese sank their ocean-going fleets and never became a world power as a result.
Exactly. We're almost at the end, so we're going to do three more. Here, here, and here. And actually, you haven't said anything yet. So we'll do you, 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 and you, and then we'll come back to the panel for the end. Good.
Bringing us back to the subject of literature, if you have transhumans who get better and better, which essentially become, you know, less likely to fail, how would you proceed as a writer? What would be the Achilles heel, either of the protagonist transhuman or the antagonist prohuman?
The transhumans are going to get sick. You know, that's, everybody's going to get sick. You've got a self-replicator, a self-repairing mechanism. Something is going to go wrong. There's going to be some disease of dysregulation in there. And I think one of the challenges is to figure out what are these diseases? What are they going to, what's going to happen?
And one of the things I really like about Bruce Sterling's Schizmatrix is that he has, as the various iterations of longevity treatments come out, they all have flaws and side effects, you know, itching all over your body or you have psoriasis or whatever. I think that's one of the things we need to see more of in fiction is the kind of the unintended consequences. Let's do a closing colloquy. Matt, do you have any closing thoughts?
Well, you know, I guess the only closing thought is this idea that if we do come to the point where we edit ourselves, we've talked about laws that might prevent it or people being afraid that they might make themselves insane or kill themselves, and it's that I don't think that laws are going to stop any of this from happening. I think that if it's possible to happen, it's going to happen. And I think that people being afraid of the risks, that's not going to stop anybody from doing these things. And so walling off all of the negative consequences behind, you know, certainly there's going to be laws against it, or certainly people are not going to want to do this because it's risky. But I think that's ignoring it's ignoring the story potentials in all of this. That, you know, if we, a story is something that, a good story is something's gone wrong, and how did it go wrong, and how can it be fixed? And so, just to think about all of the negative consequences is not necessarily a way of just hiding your head in the sand. It's a way of, you know, really working through what's going to happen. And so, I think that's an important thing to always keep in mind is that we can't just ignore the negative consequences. We really have to explore them.
Just to echo that, in the Tiptree panel that I was attending an hour or so ago, there was a comment that the best contemporary gender issues are being raised in novels that aren't about gender issues. They just kind of take alternative gender configurations for granted and make people think about what the consequences might be. And they were giving the example of Ken MacLeod's, again, Ken MacLeod comes in, Ken MacLeod's most recent novel where he has a society where gender is determined by your occupation, and he uses he and she systematically to refer to occupation as opposed to actual biological gender. I think that's, for me, maybe what the problematic I gave the panel was, does science fiction have a mission to, just like the old Futurians, to change society by projecting a transhuman future that's a positive future? Maybe actually what we need to do is project a transhuman future and then work out what it's going to, you know, what right. Living that kind of life might be like with all of its ups and downs.
And I mean, I'll wrap up mine by agreeing with you on that and suggesting that one of the writers that I think has best dealt with this idea, specifically in terms of near future changes, you know, near future transhumanism changes, how it'll affect society, even the idea of not having to go to work and so forth and having everything provided for you and where that can go drastically wrong, is Nancy Kress, specifically in Beggars in Spain series. Absolutely marvelous, flippant series. And Nancy does it better than anybody else, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of dealing with those issues in a realistic fashion and actually addressing what can go wrong. I mean, in Beggars in Spain, she virtually creates a utopia. Of course, the utopia has serious problems, and she just deals with that extremely well. So if you actually want to address those issues and look at them in terms of a very near future way, and see somebody do an absolutely fine job of it. Pick up Nancy's Beggars in Spain series, Beggars in Spain being the first book, and then come back and think about it again after that. And that's my spiel. Go for it.
Okay, well, I was going to tell you about the novel that I'm working on right now, or that I recently finished, is a world in which the real super halves of the world can create these replicas of themselves as kind of a backup copy in case anything goes wrong. You know, they fall out an airplane or something and die. They can reanimate themselves and basically come back to life, which is in a way a transhumanist kind of idea of immortality. And the way I dealt with it in that is the super have-nots, you know, the way on the other end of the scale, have are very jealous of the technology, but are also creating their own semi-religion, which I call the Church of Man, the Transcendent. And the idea is that each individual must aspire to this kind of immortality, but the price of doing that is to transcend their own mortality and all the flaws of humanity, the social problems, the greed, all those other problems that make so many of the scary issues that we've talked about, and that is what they have to do in order to be able to be deserving of the technology. And I think that's the only way we could do it and not destroy humanity as we know it now, sort of.
I think the President's Council on Bioethics actually agrees with you that we would have to be angels before we could become post-human. So.
Angels is going too far, but...
more perfect.
Yeah, closer than we are now.
Thank you very much for coming. You've been listening to a panel on speculative fiction and transhumanism that was held at the 14th Annual ReaderCon, a science fiction convention held every summer in Burlington, Massachusetts. The panelists were myself, Jay Hughes, Jennifer Barlow, Marcel Gagne, and Matt Jarpy. To find out more about ReaderCon, go to readercon.org. The 2003 schedule is already posted there. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.